You can hear the San Francisco Opera today at 1 here on KUAC. This is KUAC FM in Fairbanks. The weather for Fairbanks calls for cloudy with a little snow and fog today. North winds 10 miles an hour this afternoon and highs in the low 30s. Currently it is 33 degrees under cloudy skies with southwest winds at 6 miles an hour. It's time now for the Home Fires Radio Show with Patty Kostelic.
Good morning, and welcome to the Home Fires Radio Show. It's real crowded in the studio today because I have a lot of musicians with me, people who play traditional Irish music. And I'm going to introduce you all first. I have with me, in no particular order, Charlie Hunt, Romany Wood, Betty Baker, Lynn Basham, Bill Wolf, Mick Malcrone. Mulcrone. Sorry, Bill Connor and Kim Meeker. Welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. This is a nice way to warm up our first snowy Saturday morning. Since there are so many of you, I don't know who to direct which question to, but I'd like one of you to talk a little bit about traditional Irish music. How long does this tradition go back? One assumes a long time.
Well, I guess the music as it's played now probably reached its present form around 1800, and it has been evolving all through the 18th century, and has, you know, there are tunes being written, new tunes being added to the tradition every year, and you know, you could say it's part of a much broader tradition that encompasses American and British and Scottish music, and there's been a lot of cross influences going on in between all those traditions.
So it's certainly not a static
not at
form
all.
Of music. It's changing.
Yeah, and if you come to the concert that's coming to Fairbanks on November 3rd, you'll hear some very obvious contemporary influences on it, and at the same time some very old traditional influences.
Yeah, there's tunes that are being played today that have been played for 300 or 400 years easily.
Uh-huh. And are there purists within this tradition that don't like no purists?
There's every breed of a cat.
Okay. It seems not atypical. I have a record here in front of me, a record cover, and there is a session going on, a picture of a session going on, and it looks like it's real crowded. Where do you usually play this music? Where is it played? Is
everywhere
it
but church.
Everywhere but church.
Many houses in the woods.
In the kitchen, in the church. Your
in bars.
In bars, yeah.
Your group is not a group. We talked about this a little bit before we went on the air. You call it a session, and you have a variety of people that join in. It just happens that there are the eight of you here today, but sometimes there are other people and not you. It's not a formal kind of organization.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're talking about getting together tonight, and there'll probably be a few other folks there. There was a accordion player who couldn't make it this morning who will probably be playing tonight. So.
How did you find each other? How did you find out that you all like this kind of music?
Well, people that are fanatics, one of the first things that they tend to do when they get moved to a town is actively search for other fanatics. Irish musicians, and I guess that applies to people that play any kind of music. Music in general is a great social vehicle, and you can move into a town if you play a given kind of music and run into a circle of acquaintances real fast.
Mm-hmm. I think you have contacts too. I came up here a year ago and already knew that there were some people up here and had some names and kind of ran across people.
Called them. And
yeah.
If you wear an Irish T-shirt, like in the grocery store, someone behind us played Irish music and gave us a list about four names. And Bill Wolf being one of them, by the way, and we like Irish music.
Pays to advertise, huh?
Wear an Irish T-shirt and you can...
You've obviously lived a variety of places. Are there people who play Irish music almost everywhere? Is this some well-known underground?
Any place in Europe or North America, right. Just about.
Not any place in North America. I lived in Wyoming and Colorado, and I was very lonely.
Oh, even the mountains of Albania.
Yes, but all I had to do was go over the passes to Seattle, and it was a hotbed. So.
So there are places in the United States where this is more popular than others?
Eastern Seaboard.
Any big city, and then pockets in small towns.
Wherever the Irish have gone, and they've gone everywhere.
One of the places that I think it can be found easily, if you're going into a town, not easily, but a good possibility, is going to a dance, contra, or square dance, because a lot of people who are involved with country contra music will also be sidelining Irish music.
I see a lot of advertisements around town for contra dancing, mm-hmm. and there's quite an active contra dancing group here, is that correct?
Yeah, big dance last night.
Yeah, several of us here, especially Romney and Bill and Betty and myself and Kim and Lynn are active in that. So.
Before, we're going to play some music here in the studio. We're not really set up for music. The mics that we use here are really for the spoken word rather than for music. And so I'm going to ask the audience to sort of try and enjoy the live quality of the music that we play here this morning and understand that the acoustics aren't the best and this isn't the best fidelity. And that probably the best way to hear this is to go where they're playing live and to enjoy it on that level. But before we do that, I would really like to talk about some of these instruments. What instruments are used in the music and a little bit about them. And any of you that want to take this question, go ahead.
Well, I think the three major instruments that were played during the first stages of modern Irish music were the fiddle and the old-style wooden flute and the Irish pipes, the Irish bagpipe, which we don't have an example of here, but suffice it to say it's the most elaborate bagpipe oldest. In the world. It's played, it's not the oldest, it's the newest. Mm-hmm. It's played with bellows to inflate the bag so you can talk or drink beer out of with a straw or sing while you're playing.
No lies.
The fiddle is basically a violin, the same basic instrument, and the flute that's used mostly is an old style flute that was played in European orchestras right up till 1850, and still hung on until the early 1900s, and that's probably still played mainly because Ireland was a poor, isolated country, and the peasantry couldn't get a hold of metal flutes when they first came out, and so it's and in a lot of ways it's a more suitable instrument for the music.
Does it have in what way is it different from the more modern flute?
The fingering is much simpler, and it's having open holes. You can do a lot of sliding around, so instead of just being able to go from, you can go. Smears and little effects like that, which are played in the music.
They're made of very beautiful wood. Is this rosewood, Bill?
This
one is rosewood, yeah.
Various hardwoods. And why do they, why can you slide them in and out?
That's the tuning
slide. What is this wooden piece that you have here? Is the drum?
Yeah, one of the other instruments that Bill didn't talk about is called a baran, and that's a drum instrument that is circular, almost about the same size as some of the native drums up here, but the wood is a little bit wider and usually covered with a goat skin, and then there's a wooden stick that's sometimes used. Sometimes people will just use their fingers to beat it, but there's it's kind of the part of the percussion section for Irish music.
sort of a little round part on each end, and it's small. It's about 6 inches.
Mm-hmm. And they vary in length. Some are shorter than that, real tiny, almost like a pencil, and some are quite a bit longer.
Mm-hmm. And
did anyone bring some bones? Do you have your bones, Charlie?
Talk about your bazooka.
Yeah.
My bones.
Well, they're
what are bones? Real bones?
They started out to human be rib real bones. And Bill and Betty have some real bones, and it's another percussion instrument that you kind of clack together. Mine are hiding over there somewhere.
Any bones will do. You sort of after you finish dinner, you just take the bones out of there.
You need to get a good
an inch and a half wide. And have to be a little longer than your hand usually.
Uh-huh. So and you clack them together like playing spoons.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Right. And
the bazooki is another.
Would you like to tell us about that, Charlie?
Well, what this instrument is actually is it's a large mandolin or mandola, another instrument that the Irish use. Well, they use plectrum instruments such as the tenor banjo, four-string banjo, and the mandolin, which was originally an Italian instrument. And I also am a mandolin player besides playing the bouzouki, the Irish bouzouki. And how the bouzouki got to Ireland is kind of an interesting story. Some of the mandolin players were looking for a larger, deeper sounding instrument that they could play both notes and chords with. The mandolin is kind of a high pitched instrument and doesn't lend itself well to chording. Mm-hmm. So, there was a musician named, I believe, Johnny Moynihan that began playing a Greek bouzouki tuned differently. I don't know exactly how he tuned it, but tuned differently than a Grecian instrument. But it was a Greek bouzouki, the instrument itself. And he began playing that in sessions in the 1960s, I believe it was. And a lot of these instruments, the Greek bouzoukis are more or less built for tourists. They're not really, you know, they're made to hang on the wall, so most of them didn't hold up to the
hard playing.
The hard playing and, you know, bars and all that. And so they began building instruments that were similar to the bouzouki, but usually not with the bulbous back of a bouzouki. And there's a lot of different types of these instruments. This one that I have was made by a friend of mine. He made it as a favor to me. I bought the materials for it.
What kind of wood is it made out of?
Well, the top is made out of Sitka spruce.
Uh-huh.
The back is maple, as well as the neck. And the sides are made of laminated wood and fiberglass, believe it or not. He's also a surfboard maker.
So you can surf on it and play it.
Very complex instrument. I mean, there's nothing simple about the construction of that. It's obviously a very skilled person.
Patty, there's some...
At the other end of it is, at the other end of the complexity range is the tin whistle or penny whistle, and it's very simple with a thipple head. And this isn't actually tin, it's made out of plastic, but... it's probably the simplest of traditional instruments.
And there's actually we're talking about the ones that we're using now. There's a longer history. You can go to Ireland and see carvings of pipers from back in the 12th, 11th century. So there was and harpists. So there was music going on using things like harps and things like whistles and, mm-hmm. and things like pipes, as well as I think it's called the timpan, which is something like a hammer dulcimer, and some of that history, the music was a little different, but some of that history can go back to 10th, 11th, 12th century.
And the other end of that is that there are new instruments constantly being added. Charlie just talked about the plectrum instruments, the tenor banjo, mandolin, and bouzouki. The accordion and concertina were added during the 19th century, and during recent years have the accordion, especially the button accordion's one of the main Irish melody lead instruments. The guitar has, during the last 20 years, has gone from a fairly rare instrument to an almost requirement at a session. And people are experimenting with electric instruments too. Electric keyboards are used by a lot of the younger bands very effectively, in a way that is pleasant to a traditional ear.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So it really, we started out talking about that, but it really is it's a very living tradition that's continuing to change.
Very
it's
much,
not simply
very complex,
keeping the past alive, but in fact adding to it. Mm-hmm. And there doesn't seem to be anything sacred about what instruments you use. So that makes a session a really loose thing. I mean, you don't have to wait for someone playing some specific instrument to show up in order to make music.
You won't see too many saxophones or fuzz guitars.
And actually, some people, there are Irish musicians who play saxophones, I've been at sessions where somebody that didn't know a thing about Irish music was able to disrupt things pretty effectively by blasting away with one.
A lot of the Irish, the big Irish names in music, traditional music, have used a lot of electric instruments. For instance, the band that was a Bothy band, half of it are the people that will be playing November 3rd. Michal O'Donnell and Kevin Burke. And the other half of that band formed an electric band that uses a soprano saxophone quite often with the pipes, and sometimes it's hard to distinguish the two. They have a very similar sound, or at least the way this soprano saxophone player plays it. Of course, they play more rock and roll music, but there is a traditional edge to a lot of their tunes.
And they certainly have a traditional background because they used to be in a traditional band.
Some of them are old rockers, too.
Uh-huh.
Another instrument that on Kaylee bands, which are the bands that play for dancers, they'll use snare drums sometimes, which is kind of interesting.
And a piano backup. Mm-hmm. So that's the other side of it. That goes back to the more 40s, 50s kind of sound.
But that's also another part of Irish traditional music and dance.
Well, let's try one. And again, I please ask my audience to bear with us and understand this is not going to be the best fidelity here. We're here to convey the idea, not the very best sound, because we aren't set up for it. But let's try it because it's so much fun to listen to.
We're going to do two jigs. One is called Banish Misfortune, and the other is the Blarney Pilgrim.
Okay. Here we go. Thank you. What was that? Was a reel?
Two jigs.
I'm doing very well here. I have a choice. Three choices, and I. Okay, maybe we should. I'm not the only one who is ignorant of the differences and the kinds of categories of songs. Someone want to talk about the difference between a jig and a reel and a.
Actually, there are quite a few different types of Irish tunes. I mean, very many types. Most people think of just jigs and reels, perhaps. But there are also what they call double jigs and slip jigs and
single jigs.
Maybe
we should just start with just jigs.
It's essentially all dance music, and it's different rhythms.
Okay, yeah. Any dance tune should have some identifiable rhythm that'll get your foot tapping if you're interested in tapping your foot, and hopefully even if
you're not.
I don't
see how you can help it. My foot was just, I don't know if it was tapping appropriately, but it was tapping.
You know, like we could talk in musicological terms about mm-hmm. sixth-eighth time and all that kind of stuff, but to simplify as much as possible, the tunes are classified according to what the division of notes is per foot tap.
Uh-huh.
And in a jig, there are three notes, so it's a group of triplets for every foot tap. It's da 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 da. And if you like the first tune there or the second tune, it's 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3, and a reel would have four main notes.
So we're talking like the difference between a waltz and a foxtrot and a tango.
That's exactly
and a,
right. Exactly
so on
right.
and so forth, except that there are different dance steps mm-hmm. to this.
It's not all dance music either. There's marches and there's what they call slow airs, which are the melodies of songs that were sung in traditional fashion. So
and then there are hornpipes, which have the dotted type rhythm, mm-hmm.
syncopated.
Yeah,
yes.
A syncopated rhythm,
like mm-hmm. like similar to a reel, except much more strongly accented. Mm-hmm. So you would it'd be like almost two notes per foot tap, and with a syncopation.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the music did come from some kind of celebrations, though, and there were May Day celebrations, where things where even some of the marches were used, mm-hmm. and sometimes the marches would start off as a march, and then they'd move into going into jig rhythm with the same or essentially the same tune. They also had, besides just their home entertainment, there was also larger village things, like something they called a cake dance, I guess it was, mm-hmm. where people would get together and try to take the cake, essentially, and the best dancer or best pair of dancers would be the ones who won the cake for that weekend.
So it was a sort of informal competition? How was it judged? By
you know, I think probably,
consensus?
I'm not sure, probably by the crowd, yeah, but the piper and the fiddler would be getting pennies tossed to them as the dancers were danced.
Is that a typical thing to throw money at the musicians?
Well,
not typical enough.
Unfortunately, it's one tradition that's past dying.
that's one you'd like to bring back.
It's not uncommon, though, being in Dublin this summer, to see a lot of street musicians just up and down the street, and they all definitely had the hats out or their
buskers.
Their instrument cases open for the coins, so definitely the coins are still being passed.
What's
places.
A busker?
The street musicians.
They're called buskers?
Yes.
Yeah, that's not an Irish term. It's you know, like a jazz sax player in Greenwich Village is called a busker,
really?
Too, sure.
I have no idea. I've never heard that term.
Anything you pass in Pike Street Market with an instrument in its hand.
It's a busker. Betty, that brings me to another question. How popular is this music there? How prevalent is this? I mean, we mm-hmm. go through phases in the United States where folk music is really popular. During the late 50s and early 60s it was, but now it's more limited just to a special interest group that's interested in folk music. Is this something that, in general, the Irish population is involved with, or is it...
The country is divided up into counties, similar to states in the United States. And there are definitely specific counties that are more actively involved with the traditional Irish music, County Clare and County Kerry are the ones that come to mind quickly, and Sligo on the west coast and northwest coast. And these counties are places where you'll see on, it's the children start it from the very early age. In kindergarten, they not only bring their scissors and paste and crayons, they bring their penny whistles. Mm-hmm. And for the first 2 years, they're playing penny whistles, and then they start playing either the accordion or fiddle at age 7 or 8. Mm. So that by the time you go into a pub, you know, in County Clare, you've got 16-year-olds who are playing by far better than us. And so those counties are real strong, and yet when you visit another county, there may be a gathering of 80 people and no one plays the music at all. They're very much into a contemporary American
mode. Immigration destroyed a lot of the backbone of traditional music.
But it's
when the Irish immigrated to the
United States. Right, a lot of, like, certain counties were all but depopulated of their musicians, so the traditions kind of withered away. And also in many quarters, traditional music was associated with backwardness because of British colonialism. So,
And that was something that was real important to get away from. For, the whole Paddy image of being
dumb. So it had real negative connotations.
Yeah. And that affected the music. It also affected the language and affected the dance. So a lot of people moved away from the traditions because they wanted to be more
modern,
yeah.
Sophisticated, whatever.
If you go to Ireland today and you turn on the radio, for instance, mostly what you'll hear is popular music. Mm-hmm. And surprisingly, country and Western music is very popular in Ireland. There's quite a few country and Western bands. It is a rural country, you know, like it has a lot of farming still. And the people somehow relate to country and Western music.
The traditional music is undergone a renaissance in the past 10 years.
Yeah,
it is everywhere. It's just not,
but
it's not a consumerist.
You know,
kind
not
of
everyone in Ireland plays traditional music.
Or knows of anything about it at all.
And most of the Irish musicians that I met, I played in Europe with an Irish musician, and I went to Ireland to visit with his family, and he and all his friends learned Irish music from records. Mm-hmm. They didn't learn it from a traditional.
But they're Dubliners.
That's
too,
a lot of where you live. Yeah, it's a lot of what your family background is.
Like Irish music throughout most of this century has been in much much worse shape in Ireland than it is right now. Mm-hmm. It's like in 1900. Mm-hmm.
It was mostly over here.
No, that's true. Like Irish music owes its present existence to a large degree to two spurts of activity in the 20th century in the United States. First, right around the turn of the century, a chief of police in Chicago, Francis O'Neill, collected Irish musicians and notated their tunes. He would give them jobs on the police force to keep them in town.
Or jail them.
Yeah.
whichever works.
His motto, his motto was, you play or you stay.
And you could, if you gave him a few good tunes, you might get out earlier.
But if he knew you had a lot of them, though, he'd keep you even longer. So it was a very delicate situation to involve oneself.
He compiled collections of thousands of tunes that had never been notated before, and those books went back to Ireland and influenced a new generation of Irishmen who, again, emigrated in waves later in the century. And during the 40s, some of that wave made the first significant recordings of Irish music, especially a group of fiddlers from County Sligo. Mm-hmm. Then those records, in turn, went back, and you meet any practicing Irish musician today, and his repertoire and style is totally influenced by both those publications and those recordings.
There were some other groups, though, that also helped bring that. I think the Gaelic League did some things in the late 19th century, early 20th century, to help revive both the language, the dance, and the music.
They tried.
Yeah, I think there were some attempts. I think the Cultus Kiltori is another group that currently today is trying to do some things or has been doing some things. And there's also a group in Dublin called Na Pibrillin that is very much trying to keep the tradition alive, specifically on the pipes, but also some dance and other.
But it's funny about the talking about Irish counties versus cities. Any large city in Anglo-American, in the Anglo-American world or British-American world, has been a hotbed of Irish music for a long time. London, New York, Chicago. And Dublin, within Ireland, Dublin has attracted musicians from all over the country for so long that it could properly be considered mm-hmm. to have a musical tradition of its own, and in sure. a very lively one.
Especially a piping tradition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
An interesting part of the economics, part of what you were talking about, immigration, is one of the things about the country of Ireland itself is that they can't support all the musicians that are playing traditional music and playing it very, very well. And so those folks in the wintertime, when there are no Irish tourists, will all come to the United States, which has such a huge area and population to address itself to, and that's where they'll be coming over to concert and to
and
make
to Fairbanks.
And to Fairbanks.
And that's how we're going to get Joe Burke, and it says on his record that he's a national resource for Ireland. So
yeah, he's been living in New York for a long time.
Because
and
he
that's
has
a resource
more
of the Bronx anyway.
Because he gets more work.
Right.
Sure,
right.
Yeah, there's no putting themselves back there.
You just, in the Fairbanks tradition of bringing resources here that you wish to have, you just decided that you were going to bring these people up? Informal group?
Well, we were talking about sessions before. There was a session we were having last spring and kind of got talking about these musicians who were going to be in Ketchikan and decided that night that we would somehow figure out some way of getting them up here. And so this started last spring, I guess. And a lot of us have been doing some work since then to sign them and to try to do some publicity. But there are three excellent musicians coming up November 3rd and playing at the UAF Fine Arts Theater. One of them is Kevin. One is Joe Burke, the person you just mentioned, who is a superb
accordion.
Accordion Joe Burke.
We don't have an accordion here in the studio today, so you're going to.
Unfortunately, Fairbanks's Irish accordion player Noel Higgins, who's a friend of Joe Burke's he's from Ireland as well, was unable to make it because he's working today.
Okay, but so Joe Burke is coming, and is Kevin Burke coming? Are they related?
No, they're not related.
No, just
Kevin Burke and Micheál O'Donnell are the two that Charlie mentioned were in the Bothy band. There, again, superb musicians.
These people, you learn from each other, correct? So I mean, it really seems a strong community that goes over a great distance. I mean, you seem to be aware of the top musicians, other places, and so on. Even though they may not be household words, they are to you.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, like Bill Wolf was saying, there's a network of people probably across the country and throughout Canada that, you can kind of almost drop into any city and be hooked up. These people travel a lot, too. They're kind of these people that are coming up here. They're itinerant musicians, I guess you could say.
For instance, like last June, I went to a conference in Atlanta that had to do with my job, and while I was there at the hotel that I was staying at, there were some musicians walking around, mostly playing Russian music. And I started talking with them, and I play other types of music as well as Irish music, so I began playing with them, and they were, having played acoustic-type instruments, they were aware of the Irish musicians in town, which apparently there aren't too many in Atlanta, or at least that they knew about. But I did get in contact with them, and we did have a session, and that's typical, I think, of most of the people in this room. If we go anywhere, somehow the word gets around. That I met three of these people, within the first week I was here in Fairbanks 2 years ago in a room where Irish music was being played.
I know that Bill and I work in the same building, and I think the first week I met you, you said, "Do you know any musicians in town that play Irish music?" It was a real pressing matter with him to get connected and find a kitchen.
Even moved in yet.
Yeah, then find a place to stay.
First things first, find out where the musicians live. Right. Okay, why don't we? I want to tap my toe a little bit more. So why don't you play something else for us here? And again, I will remind our audience, this is not for fidelity, but for enthusiasm and to give you a taste of it.
These are a pair of reels, and the first is called Dick Gossips, and the second one is a classic old tune called The Star of Munster.
Four.
Four notes to the tap.
That's not counting ornaments.
Okay, get your feet ready. Lively. Now, the songs have some wonderful names. The dogs among the bushes. This implies that there must be some lyrics or
no,
are there words?
A sense of humor.
A sense of
it's just that there are thousands of tunes and that it's necessary to come up with something to some means of keeping track of them. And so after a few hundred sort of common names run out and you have to start reaching.
Right. Gorman's Trip to the Cottage, Tatterjack Walsh, The Bank's Sporting Nell, The Smell of the Bog.
That's a wistful tune of immigration.
The Flogging Reel, Patty Lynn's Delight. Are these written by...
I don't think, I'd probably get argument for this, but I'd in my own mind, I don't think any of these were ever really written. I think they were played, and then somebody came along, and a good many of them came from the hands of people that weren't trained musicians, you know?
In recent years, you have a few tunes popping up that were composed by identified individuals, and the recording industry makes it possible to disseminate those among practicing musicians a lot faster than was the case in the old days. In the old days, somebody would start playing a tune, and it would take a long time for it to get around, and it would go through a lot of changes in the process. So it was
true oral tradition.
Very yeah, exactly. And,
that's one of the things.
That's how the stuff survived too. I mean, it didn't survive in academic circles. It survived in people's kitchens. And
I find it interesting the tunes, the way that many of the tunes are put together. It seems like it's they were written not to be played easily on the instruments that they were made to play. Like, for instance, you know, like after you play Irish music a lot, there are identifiable runs, so to speak, or
a repertoire of
phrases.
Yes, that's a better word. Phrases. But the variations on those phrases quite often amaze me, that someone would put their fingers in those contorted positions. You know, like that they had a very specific idea of how to play the music. In other words, it wasn't just, well, maybe it started out as an accident, I don't know, but I don't think so, because, you know, like, because of the complexity of some of the tunes, not all of them, but quite often they don't lend themselves all that well to being played on the fiddle or the flute or whatever. That you really have to work at playing, you know, a lot of these tunes.
We're talking about the complexity. You know, I think one of the real basic instruments, the Irish pipes, that's just amazing complexity. You've got at least four different things going on there at once. Bill was talking before, you have the bellows, which is something you're squeezing with one arm to produce to get your air, and then then you have a bag that is giving you that you're putting pressure on to give to actually the air into the pipes itself. And then you have the fingering on your chanter, so you've got two hands going on that, and then at the same time you've got your drones going, and then finally you've got regulators, which are often used for chords and for rhythm, and this is all being played by one person who may also be singing at the same time.
And hopefully.
And telling lies.
And drinking beer, as you point out. You have to be relatively well coordinated.
Yeah.
I don't think that's an instrument that I would take up. Now, it is something, though, that there are some simple instruments, like the penny whistle, and many of you seem to play a number of instruments. Is that typical in Irish music that you...
I think, you know, not any more than in music in general. I think most flute players and pipers automatically play the tin whistle, just because it's a cheaper instrument. It's a somewhat simpler instrument, not necessarily easier, but simpler than either the flute or the pipes. And it's typically what people learn on to get a grasp of the music before investing in a flute or a set of pipes. On the other hand, there are some flute players that couldn't play a whistle to save their lives. You know, and good flute
and
players.
And similarly, say like a mandolin player would. Most mandolin players get to play guitar, or if they play Irish music, quite often they also play tenor, banjo, and
mandolin player can also
bazooki.
Can also pick up a fiddle really easily because it's most the same fingering and just learn the bowing.
Most accordion players seem to have a fondness for playing cards as well.
You've noticed that it's a correlation: cards and accordions. If you're a good card player, you might
Fairbanks
consider that.
Fairbanks
accordion players play cards.
The accordion player Joe Burke, who's coming up to Fairbanks, also plays flute, and to me that's not a real common
it's
mixture.
it's not that unusual. Like Sean McGlynn, who died last winter, was a great flute player.
Better watch out, Bill.
Chris DeKeevil, he's a New England style accordion player down in Portland, and I met him in Wasilla last spring, and he did a pretty decent job on the wood flute.
Would you say that it's difficult kind of music as a genre, as a is it difficult, is it easy, can if someone wants to learn to play Irish music?
What's attractive about it to me, as opposed to say bluegrass music, which I love to listen to, and you know I admire bluegrass musicians very much, but I think what's attractive to Irish musicians is the fact that it is a melodic type of music, and that usually everybody else knows what everybody else is doing. That is, they're playing the melody, except for the guitar player who's playing rhythm or something. But, you know, like, and there is room for variation in some of the tunes, but basically the tune is very, you know, the parameters of what you play are pretty, fairly narrow as far as the melody is concerned, whereas bluegrass music, for instance, there's a lot of improvisation that goes on. And that doesn't mean that Irish music, you know, there aren't people that change the melodies or augment them, but the basic, you know, structure is always there.
There are definite confines, you know, in terms of taste. You know, like there's things that great players do in terms of variation that sound utterly wild and fantastic, but they're within what's considered tasteful and
boundaries.
You could do things to Irish music that would be and are grossly offensive to any Irish musician.
But so there is an aesthetic here.
The difficulty, which I think your question was addressing, I've heard, you know, fiddlers talk about it being very difficult to play Irish music because there's so many notes in one tune, and I don't play country or Western music, so I can't do anything but hear what people have told me. But what they say is, you know, you can play a lot fewer notes in those kind of pieces, as opposed to you get a lot of note variations in the melody of Irish tunes.
When we were talking about the oral tradition and handing these songs around, learning them, I guess, just at sessions, when you go to Ireland or when you change towns and go to a session, is it in fact, do you discover that you know the same songs? And
it depends on how many tunes you know.
Right. You know, like, there's literally thousands of.
It also depends what part of the country you go to. For instance, I sat in a session in Dublin, where, and I brought my instrument to play, and I managed to play one tune that they played all reels. For instance, in Dublin, well, that's not always true, but I think Dublin is known for their reel playing. And this particular session, they didn't play anything but reels, the whole session. And there was one tune I knew and another that I had heard before, and every other tune I had never heard before in my life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are
a lot of tunes.
Thousands of tunes.
Yeah, in terms of being easy or hard, you know, I don't think there's any kind of music that's easy to play. I think that's a myth, that playing any kind of music well requires a lot of work and dedication. Irish music is no exception. You know, like, it's a lifetime job trying to learn what's considered an adequate store of tunes and all the techniques required to play them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like there's more than there is, for example, in the bluegrass tradition. There are many, many more, although maybe I'm not correct in that.
I don't know. A bluegrass musician has to recompose his tune every time he plays it, you know, top bluegrass musician.
The comparison I'm trying to make is that if you play bluegrass music and have for some period of time, if you go to a bluegrass festival, there's a sort of standard repertoire of songs, and it's not going to be that difficult if you're a good musician to just fit right in fairly quickly. And I guess that's what my question. Right, and that's what I'm saying. Is this the same kind of thing?
To have a substantial repertoire of Irish tunes, you probably have to know several hundred.
I see.
Several hundred tunes. So.
Yeah, but there's so many thousands to choose from. Right. It doesn't, you know.
I don't know if you know the right 200. Right.
But we're all pretty influenced by records and things like that, and so the repertoire that we share is very much a record repertoire. Like, you know, we've all listened to the Bothy Band a lot.
Right. In reading the back of this record, it says that this particular record was very hard to find and became a sort of underground classic because it was so difficult to find. And when Carla and I were putting it on the turntable, she noticed that it was in monaural, which is an unusual thing to find in a record these days. Is it hard to get these records?
Not anymore, but up until probably till this recent Renaissance, about 12. Maybe at the most 15 years ago, it was difficult to find, and musicians that were recorded recorded under very rough and primitive conditions, and they weren't
often
compensated.
Often in bars.
It's true.
Someone just took a tape recorder along.
Hotel room or living room or basement or wherever it might be convenient. So a lot of them have come back into print.
I've got one record of traditional singing in Gaelic, and every, you know, there's one song, and every so often you hear this truck right outside the window.
Door slamming.
Toilet flushing.
So it's only recently, well, relatively recently, that it's become a commercial commodity. And since there's money to be made, it's become much more polished.
But you still have to know how to, you still have to buy record catalogs or order record catalogs and know how to use them. It's a mail order market. And in terms of going down to your local store in towns the size of Fairbanks or in Anchorage, there you can usually find some, but very limited.
Right, in that tiny international music bin that has one record from every country.
Right. I'd like to speak a little about two of the people that are going to be playing here. I don't know, I'm not we've all heard them extensively, Michal O'Donnell and Kevin Burke on records. I have seen both of those people play in, I don't know, has anybody else actually seen them play?
Yeah, I've seen them a couple of times.
And there used to be, back in Massachusetts, a folk festival every year that was devoted more or less to Gaelic music. And I went to that. I used to go to that more to hear the American tunes that would come out every once in a while. But I remember I had never heard of the Bothy Band before, and I wasn't interested in that at that time in Irish music. But, and I went to this concert where they were playing. They played last, and I was almost asleep. The music wasn't that great that evening overall. But when they came on the stage, it was electrifying. And I, even though I didn't know much about Irish music, I knew that, you know, like something special was happening. And I highly recommend anybody who's interested in any kind of folk music go to this concert on November 3rd.
Well, it's very infectious music. What if we pique someone's interest and they want to join in a session? Is there someone they can call if they don't know Irish music but would like to learn? Is there a formal way that you can do it? No? Come to the concert?
Go to
the corner of 2nd and Cowles with your penny whistle and start playing.
People who come to the contra dances. The contra dancing is, it's a lot of dancing, but it's also a real social scene. Uh-huh. And the people who play for the contra dances are almost, by and large, the same people. And, mm-hmm. Or they certainly know Fairbanks is still pretty small. And word gets around real fast. And I think that Bill and Mick met here at the contra dance. First met Bill Connor at the contra dance. He came, and that was kind of how he met Bill Wolf also. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's advertised on KUAC.
Do they teach contra dancing if you don't know how to do the dancing?
Yeah, all instructions given, and we kind of work up through the course of an evening, work up the complication of dances so that people have a little bit, beginners have a little bit of time to get initiated.
Yeah. And this is an example of two traditions that are very distinct but closely related, you know, working side by side.
Patty, you were talking about piquing people's interest. If we pique people's interest in the music, this is dance music, and there is a way to learn some of the Irish dancing. Betty and I are teaching some lessons through the community schools program starting in 2 weeks, so that will be another way of becoming involved in the Irish tradition if folks are interested in doing that.
We have a program on KUAC, too, on Friday between 4 and 5 in the afternoon called The Thistle and Shamrock. And that's a popular program. So obviously there's lots of interest. And so I do encourage you, if you're interested, if the audience is interested, to go to some contra dances. And they're well advertised in town, actually. Is that quite a bit? How many people?
It's every 2 weeks.
Uh-huh. And they're advertised on KUAC what's happening. So anyone who's listening to the radio, keep listening.
How many people show up?
We probably have
70.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Night.
Oh, yeah. 60 or 70
that's
people.
That's pretty typical.
Rivaling square dancing.
There's no contest.
No contest?
We're just there. But it's every 2 weeks, so it was this yesterday. So in two weeks, it will be again on a Friday night.
Good way to get some exercise.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe somebody somebody here could explain the difference, say, between square dancing and contra dance. I don't know if that's worthwhile pursuing, but I think, you know, like, sometimes it's not clear in my mind.
Which kind of square dancing you're talking
that's
about.
That's true.
It's doing that.
One thing I wanted to mention, to anyone who thinks they've never heard of Kevin Burke and was thinking, well, I often go through this. I kind of think, well, I don't know who this person is. I don't know what kind of music they play. I'm not going to go. A lot of people may have heard him play on an Arlo Guthrie record. So a lot of people who are interested in folk music listen to Arlo Guthrie. He's played on that, and likewise, a lot of the musicians who I've noticed on Arlo Guthrie's record, I've noticed on Kevin Burke's record, backing Kevin up. Mm-hmm. So he may be more familiar than he seems.
Yeah, and Michal O'Donnell has played with Gray Larson and
Malcolm Douglas.
Malcolm Douglas.
He's played with Billy Oski on Wyndham Hill Records too, which is sweet stuff.
Yes. What I'm going to do is have you close the show by playing. So I'm going to thank you and go through all my business here before you start, and then we can just continue playing. I want to thank Charlie Hunt, Romney Wood, Betty Baker, Lynn Basham, Bill Wolf, Mick Malcrone, Bill Connor, Kim Meeker. I'm sorry, I mangled it again. What is it? Say what it is.
I'm thinking of having a change.
Just a Mick.
I got to change my name first.
I've mangled simpler names than that. Mulcrone?
Mulcrone, right.
Oh, well, no. Another couple hours, I'll have it. I thank you for joining us on the Home Fires Radio Show. The executive producer has been Carla Tonella. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic, and I've had a lot of fun. It's real lively, infectious, toe-tapping music, as you say, and I think I'm going to come to one of those contra dances time soon. Shake a leg, tap a foot. Thank you very much. It's been fun this morning, and I hope you have a pleasant weekend. Enjoy that snow.
These are polkas?
Yes.
Irish polkas.
Irish polkas. So here
Ready?
We go.
Curry.
Ready?
You're listening to KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's now 15 seconds before, 1 minute after 12 o'clock, and time for the National Press Club.
Support for this program is provided by NPR member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Bank America Foundation for Business and Economic Reporting, the Christopher Reynolds Foundation for Southeast Asia Reporting, and for the coverage of science, Hewlett Packard, worldwide supplier of computers and instrumentation for business and science. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Washington, D.C., National Public Radio presents another in the continuing series of broadcasts from the National Press Club. I'm Eva Grant, and today's guest speaker is Joseph Boyle, president of the American Medical Association.
And after spending 2 weeks in San Francisco covering the Democratic National Convention, I can tell you how glad it is to be the Washington correspondent and be back in Washington. 3,000 miles from the office is just about the right distance. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members and their guests seated in the audience today, as well as those of you who are listening to this program over the 281 national public radio stations or watching over the 1,300 cable systems affiliated with C-SPAN, the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network. Before going any further, I'd like to remind our members of some coming events. On Monday, July 30th, our speaker will be Nation of Islam Minister Louis Farrakhan. He will be followed on Tuesday, July 31st, by United Auto Workers President Owen Bieber. On Wednesday, August 1st, two postal worker leaders, union leaders, will share the podium. They are Mo Biller, President of the American Postal Workers Union, and Vincent Sam Broato, President of the National Association of Letter Carriers. I hope you can make as many of them as you can make. I think they'll be interesting, particularly Monday. Before going, I'd like to remind our audience at this point that if you have any questions for our speaker today, and I hope you will, it gets very lonely up here without questions, please write them on the cards at your table, send them up to me. I'll ask as many as time allows. Also, when you write them, either write as clearly as you can or print if your handwriting's like mine. Some questions don't get asked simply because I can't read them. I'd now like to introduce the guests at our head table, ask our guests to stand briefly when their names are read. I ask you and the audience to withhold your applause until I've read all of the names. Starting at my left, Casey Crawford, publisher of Healthcare Publications and a former treasurer of the National Press Club. Judy Frabata, McGraw-Hill's Washington Health Letters. Warren Leary, Associated Press. Ann Orleans, freelance writer and a member of our speakers committee who put together today's luncheon. Dr. Edward N. Brandt, Jr., Assistant Secretary for Health, Department of Health and Human Services. Judy Grandy, the chairperson of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. She's a chairperson of our speakers committee and a correspondent for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I'm still flying on adrenaline from that convention. Al Rossiter, science editor, United Press International. Alex Kirchhoff, Associate Editor for Health, U.S. News and World Report. Mary Hager, Newsweek. Victor Cohen, Washington Post. Don Kirkman, Science Editor, Scripps Howard Newspapers. Keith Haglin, Managing Editor, International Medical Tribune Syndicate. I want to thank all of our head table guests for taking time out of their schedules to be with us today. Industrialist Henry Kaiser once said that, quote, problems are opportunities dressed in work clothes, end quote. It's a saying I remind myself of each day as we progress through the renovation of the National Press Club and the National Press Building. It's also a saying that might be useful to our speaker today. For after decades as one of the nation's most influential organizations, the AMA today finds itself in a state of flux. 20 years ago, the AMA claimed the membership of 79% of the nation's physicians. Today, about 50% of the nation's physicians belong to the organization. Instead of signing up with the AMA, doctors are joining some 62 medical specialty societies, ranging from the Aerospace Medical Association to the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. And as Dr. Brandt said during lunch, if you get three doctors together, they form a society. The growth of these groups is called, quote, the disorganization of organized medicine, by one AMA president. It's been called a lot of other things by other AMA officials, but I'm not going to repeat them on the air. The man who's inherited this Excedrin headache is our speaker, Dr. Joseph Boyle, head of the American Medical Association. Dr. Boyle is a private practitioner of internal medicine and diseases of the chest in Los Angeles, California. He was elected to the AMA Board of Trustees in 1975, served as its chairman from June 1981 to June of 1983. He's been president of the California Medical Association and the Los Angeles County Medical Association. He's been Speaker of the California Medical Association House of Delegates and Delegate to the AMA's House of Delegates. He was born in Jersey City, New Jersey. He received his medical degree from Temple University. His postgraduate work was done both in New Jersey and California. In addition to being on the staff of several Los Angeles area hospitals, Dr. Boyle has been Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at the University of Southern California School of Medicine since 1954. He's a past president of the California chapter of the American College of Chest Physicians. Now, Doctor, we have a tradition that introductions at the National Press Club are supposed to be somewhat irreverent. I hope you've not been hurt by this one, but if you find yourself in distress, just take two aspirins, get plenty of rest, and call me in the morning. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the 4,200 members of the National Press Club, it's a pleasure for me to introduce to you